It's a pleasure to be here tonight. My name is Brian Kelly, and I am the Vice President for College Services here at Lane Community College. And I'd like to welcome you to Lane Community College's Longhouse. I have had the pleasure of being at the college for 14 years, and some of that is you get a little bit of institutional history. And looking through the crowd, I can see several faces who were here on the day that we walked out here and actually dedicated this spot prior to the building being erected. And it was a gorgeous day. Great birds were flying overhead, the sun was shining, the community was together, and it's a day in my Lane history, in my decade and a half, that I'll never forget, because it was an important moment in us giving to the community, recognizing the community, and being able to be a part of the community in the way we do. I often like to say Lane Community College Community is our middle name, and we're thrilled to be hosting an event here this evening. I do wanna recognize Lori Tapahanzo, who is here tonight. She is our Native American Program Coordinator, and thank you for all your hard work. And I'd like to officially welcome you to KLCC's Community Conversation, A Sense of Belonging, Native American Voices. I'm going to briefly introduce our distinguished guest this evening and then hand it over to Rachel McDonald so we can get started. I'd first like to introduce Sarah Thompson. She is the Deputy Press Secretary for the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde. I'd like to introduce Robert Kenta. He is the Cultural Resource Director for the Confederated Tribes of the Siletz Indians. He's also a long-term council member, and he is the current treasurer for his tribe. I'd like to introduce Brenda Brainard. She is the Eugene 4J Natives Indian Education Program Coordinator. And Dr. Leoni Sabzalian, she is the Assistant Professor for the Indigenous Students in Education at the University of Oregon. In the tradition of feeding the storyteller, we have some gifts for you this evening, Oregon hazelnuts, and of course, no KLCC event would be complete without a KLCC mug. So. And now it's my pleasure to introduce KLCC's news director, Rachel McDonald. She'll be our moderator for the discussion this evening. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much, everyone, for joining us for this community conversation. This stems from the news team's year-long project, a monthly series on Native Voices of Oregon. It's part of our Borders, Migration, and Belonging series funded by the U of O Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics. Thank you to the Wayne Moore Center, and I want to acknowledge Rebecca Flynn, who's co-director. Rebecca, we have a little gift for you as well. And thank you to members of the KLCC Public Radio Foundation for your support of the station and the news team. And would any board members please stand? Just wave, and we will applaud you. And I want to thank the Lane Community College Longhouse for hosting the event, and thank you to the college. If you're with the Longhouse or the college, please stand so we can acknowledge you. So I want to make a note about the format, and then we'll have introductions of the KLCC reporters and get started, and then we'll go to questions. We just want to ask for kind of time limits of 2 minutes so that we can continue, so everyone gets their voices heard, and out of respect for everyone's time. And that goes as well for, we will be going to questions from the reporters and then also questions from the audience. So we'll just ask, you know, to think about, you know, to the point questions so that the program moves forward. And after the panel, we will have time to visit and enjoy refreshments. And I also want to note that we're recording this presentation, and it will be posted at the KLCC website, klcc.org. So Brian Bull is an award-winning reporter who has been in public radio for more than 20 years. He's been with KLCC for 3 years and is a member of the Nez Perce tribe. Karen Richards has been with KLCC for 6 years. She previously worked on reporting series funded by the Wayne Moore Center on borders, migration, and belonging, and the future of education in Oregon, for which she won a Prindy Award. So now, we begin.
So just a brief summary of what this year-long monthly series was. It's a monthly feature series where Karen and I would alternate every month beginning last July on a number of topics that we felt were important to share about Native Americans in Oregon. The topics have covered everything from reclaiming history, which for many Native people is very important. A lot of the narrative had been established by pioneers, colonists, historians who may not have had the full in-depth Native perspective when they began to kind of shape the history of this region. We've covered everything from geographic place names and their significance to Native people. We've touched on issues that are very important and sometimes polarizing within the culture itself, such as Two-Spirits, which looked at a new form, or at least a newly acknowledged form of sexuality within Native American culture. And then we also looked at education, Native American veterans, the state of education. Karen just recently did a piece about Native American art, and I'm currently working on a feature that'll air later this month about the reintroduction of traditional indigenous foods as a way to establish history, culture, identity, and offset some of the problems brought about by the modern Western diet. So I've got about 90% of my interviews booked. I'm hoping to hear from the Umatilla Indian Reservation if I can go out and visit there sometime in the next week or two. So if anybody has any ins with that tribe, please let me know. But the response has been very positive, and I'm very appreciative to the Wayne Morse project to really kind of get this on the airwaves and really kind of instill, not just for non-Indians, but Indians like myself, a better sense and appreciation of the many different cultures and issues that exist out there. And the panelists that we have here have all been featured or at least been consulted on a lot of the pieces that Karen and I have done, and I've just been very grateful for their insight, their cooperation, and information. So it's been really a successful series, largely because of people able to share these perspectives with our reporters. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with that, should we start with the questions?
Yes, so just because the series is borders, migration, and belonging, a lot of the questions are going to do with the sense of belonging piece of that. And the first question, which the panelists were aware of, they will each answer, is, in your position, what are you and or your tribe doing to reclaim history and traditions and deepen a sense of belonging?
Who would like to start? We'll start with you, Sarah, if you don't mind.
Thank you. I'd be happy to defer to my leaders. Thank you. In my position as the Deputy Press Secretary for the tribe, I am on the opposite end of the storytelling spectrum as Brian and Karen, and I've been very fortunate to work with them on a number of these stories. And in reclaiming tribal history, especially for Grand Ronde, that was subject to termination, fought for restoration, and we have this, I guess, gap, for lack of a better word. And in doing so, I see a disconnect between what individuals know about the tribe and how we communicate that. Recently, I did a series through social media on the Rogue River Trail of Tears. And I used the journal of Indian agent George Ambrose to tell that story. And what I found from that, and by using different media outlets in order to communicate the history and the story of the Grand Ronde tribe, is you're able to reach a new audience, a broader audience, whether that's individuals within the community that just don't have an awareness or an understanding about what that history is, about what that history of this place is, or whether that's tribal members that live in one of 43 different states throughout the country. And how do you use different media tools, how do you use different outlets in order to share that story, to share that identity, and in a sense reclaim it?
So I've been working for my tribe for over 25 years now. And I was a shy, I was actually young at the time when I started in the position. I was kind of recruited into the position because I had always shown a great interest in the history, the culture, wanted to know about everything. I was the nuisance kid always asking questions. And so I really was recruited into the position when our tribe received its first National Park Service Historic Preservation Fund grant, and it was to establish a cultural resources program at Siletz. And very quickly we became not only focused in cultural site protection and responding to archaeological permit applications sent to us by the state and other projects that could impact cultural features and all of that. We got very into historical research and collections of archival materials, sound recordings, field notes, all those things that were scattered around the country in universities and federal repositories. And so there's a broad expanse of subjects that the department can and does get involved in. And we are, I think, at Siletz, the most diverse confederation of tribes on a single reservation. We have 10 completely different languages, most of those languages having multiple dialects, and those 10 languages divided among 5 absolutely different language families. And so that cultural diversity is important to our identity. It's important to maintain. Most of those languages, we don't have a fluent or even conversant speaker in anymore because of the federal policies that drove that out of us. And, you know, a lot of that was removing children from their homes and sending them to boarding schools. And once they graduated from there, if they showed promise as a student at Chamawa, then sometimes sent to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Haskell in Lawrence, Kansas, or other places. And, you know, the federal programming was always, even up at the termination time, there was a relocation program. It was to get Indian people off the reservation, move them to an urban inner city area, give them a job training program, and that's where they were expected to stay, where they wouldn't be a burden to the government on their own reservation. And so all of those things that broke up tribal community ties and connections to culture and to the landscape that, you know, their ancestors had lived on and managed for thousands of years, that's our goal. And so one of our big projects in recent years was working with Charles Wilkinson, who was a former University of Oregon Indian Law professor. He had come from University of Colorado Boulder while also working for NARF in the 70s to get our tribe, the first in Western Oregon to be affected by termination, to regain federal recognition. That happened in 1977. So he came back, you know, he did federal Indian law textbook and lots of articles and teaching on federal Indian law, and then he started writing about his experiences in Indian country. And we did basically a 5 or 6 year project with multiple rounds of his student interns and came out with the book, The People Are Dancing Again, a few years ago. So there's lots of things we can talk about with language revitalization and reconnection to landscape and restoration of those landscapes, those plant communities that our people depended on, and we'll get to that hopefully.
Thank you. Kwesi Chako. My name is Dr. Brenda Brainerd. I'm an enrolled member of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz. I, too, am from a terminated tribe. When I was 48 days old, my tribe was terminated, and I went to law school here at the University of Oregon with the sole purpose of effecting restoration for my tribe, and that happened in 1984. I'm the first person in my family, to ever graduate from high school, college, or professional school, and I was only the third person in my tribe to receive a doctoral degree. I believe education is essential. Education is how we take our place in society. I'm now the director of the Indian Ed Program at the 4J School District. I've been there about 23 years. And my goal in working with students who come through my program, we service about 1,200 kids in the 4J School District, tribe students from all different tribes. We serve over 100 tribes. But my goal in making those students find their place in this community and in their culture is to simply make them aware of who they are, of what they are, that they have a voice, and to use that voice. I want the students that I work with in the education system to understand the differences between westernized history and westernized views of things and those of tribal views, to learn to find their voice so that the tribal position can be heard and can be acknowledged. It's not necessarily or historically the tribal way to always speak out about the great things that tribes have done, but it's time that history had that balance. Each one of the tribal students that I serve have different cultures. It's important that those children learn their own culture as opposed to taking on a stereotypical or a media culture. And we work diligently to make sure that those children who want to seek their own culture connect with their own community, even if it's far away from Oregon, that they learn who their people are back home and the way they acted and the way they lived. With Senate Bill 13, we're very fortunate that we can spoon force feed local school districts into learning about the local tribes with an authentic and accurate voice. And in a way to, we are working and struggling in a way to do that. Lalani's been very important in that too, to make sure our local school districts get that spoon in a way that they want it as opposed to not wanting it so they can share it on. We want our children to become productive citizens of society, but to hopefully start seeing things from a tribal point of view, from a tribal culture, and from a tribal way of knowing, and then being able to articulate that back in whatever situation they're in.
Chamai hui Leilani Sabzalian, Oregon Miso Shlianga. My name is Leilani. I'm Aleutic, Alaskan native, so questions of belonging and, you know, working for my people are complicated when you're born and raised in Oregon. And then I was one of those kids who was removed from their families, right? So there's another layer of that. I first just want to share, I'm in the presence of one of my mentors, James Florendo, and he was someone who was really important to my own sense of belonging growing up. And Native youth oftentimes need affirmation that who we are is enough. And so I've spent my time trying to create spaces in which Native youth feel like they're enough and that they belong. And so part of that work in my dissertation research was to work in a school district and help create a Native youth center with local educators in this area. And then and part of our work in that center is creating this space that can be diverse, right, intertribal, because we work with a highly diverse population in urban and suburban areas, but then also create a sense of belonging with Native youth that they also recognize that if they're living in diaspora, right, they're living in other people's homelands, that they also need to recognize where they live. And so some of that work for me, that comes with the responsibility of working in service of tribal nations that are in this area. So in our youth center, that meant working with people from the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde to help create a name for our center, to create some accurate history and presence that we could share with people who came to the area. And then I also work, I'm the co-director of the Sapsi-Kwatla Teacher Education Program at the University of Oregon. And in that way, we work with tribal nations, all the tribal nations in Oregon who serve on our advisory council, to work in partnership to prepare indigenous teachers of indigenous students. And so just in the ways that education has been a site of colonization, we're trying to create spaces of belonging within public schools and tribally run schools where education can be a space of affirmation, it can be a space of sovereignty, it can be a space of cultural resurgence and revitalization.
As we go through the panel, I just want the panelists to know that we don't have any specific order that we expect the answers. We know sometimes you have the answer right there, and sometimes you need a couple moments to kind of just percolate, so there's no set order. So anytime you wish to present your answer, feel free. The next question is, in our series, we've touched on reclaiming the historical narrative, developing a sense of place through geography, strengthening indigenous education, and preserving language. Is there any one of these that you see as especially key as creating a sense of belonging, or are there other topics or issues that you think are important?
So one of the, I guess I need to move that back, sorry. I'm not used to that. I have a big voice. I don't usually need these types of assistance. So one of the things about the whole sense of belonging that we have struggled, that I've struggled mightily with my district, is a sense of understanding the diversity among tribal students and the way we look, that not all students look like TV with the leather and feathers, and that with that sense of seeing tribal students, you will see them in a way different than what you expect them to act or expect them to behave based on many of the preconceived notions that we have. Our district has struggled to try to provide so many things to so many kids. It's hard to be everything for everyone, but this last year we've been especially successful in providing an opportunity for students to learn about culture through totem pole design, totem pole carving, and totem pole placement. And each and every one of those have had great impacts on our students, in that the design lets them do research and figure out what clans and what totems are important and how they should be placed on the pole, in what order, and what they mean and the importance of that. The carving and the work and the detail that it takes has taught them many skills about math. We make them do writing about what they've learned, so we instill that sense of journaling. And then placement, where those go and why those totem poles are placed where they are, and the ceremonies that abound with them when they are placed, has provided such a strong sense of pride for our Native children that when they now walk through this community, they can see totem poles that they've prayed over and sang over and wept over for how they've been previously treated and the way they've been rehabilitated. It has been a phenomenal opportunity to see children and community members to expand their sense of this land was walked on before. This land has been inhabited by people other than just folks that drive by in cars every day. My program isn't as focused on language because we have so many different tribes. We have to defer to each student's ability to relearn their, reclaim their own languages. But as the last question, what more can be done? Everything more can be done. There is never a sense of getting close to succeeding or accomplishing this goal. As long as Native people and our students in particular walk and live every day in a world that does not have a view from their indigenous or their cultural standpoints, it's a struggle. It's a struggle for our kids. And you know, there's a Lakota word that says it's difficult to be Indian. And we want to be able to tie our students to their culture and the land, and to know that the work is never done. You've never been able to be successfully through with continuing to share your culture and the sense of belonging here. So there's so much more still to be done.
I referred a little bit to the importance of language restoration, and you get really your worldview from the words that you speak and how you put them together, how you organize those thoughts in your head. Different languages have emphasis on different things. And one example for our Southwest Oregon Athabascan language is the verb, we don't say to ride something or control it in that way. It's carrying you, or it's doing that service for you instead of you controlling it. And that's just one of many examples of how you relate to objects or people or things in the world around you. And so that lends an importance to language and in understanding the world around you. And today we're facing a lot of challenges with climate change and landscape, plant community changes, a lot of introduced invasives and farm crops, and you know, Monsanto is doing its thing with GMOs, and that could affect our native plant populations as well. And just the amount of herbicide that we put on the landscape here, trying to keep those invasives under control, or even our native plant populations are really, after a clear-cut logging, the general practice is to apply herbicide multiple times until you've pretty much wiped everything that was growing there off, so that those Douglas fir seedlings can reach skyward unimpeded. So all of those things relating to the landscape around you, that's how our cultures grew, that's how they thrived, and that's the connections we're trying to reestablish. But it's a big challenge with all of those changes we're seeing in the weather, in the seasons, the sooner arrival of those picking seasons for different food and fiber plants that we depend on for those cultural objects to be made and those foods to be served on our tables. Those seasons are arriving earlier in the season and not lasting near as long as they used to. So we've got lots of challenges we're facing. A lot of the language that's used around that planning or assessment is climate change adaptation. I'm like, I think we missed a step. There's resilience that can be built in those plant communities, and maybe that can be part of adaptation, but jumping right to, okay, these changes are coming and there's nothing we can do. We have to switch to a different mode. And I think that's ignoring the responsibilities that we have towards those species.
I, if I may chime in, I think from my perspective, from my sense of belonging is really tied to place. I am a descendant of people that walk this landscape. The resources here provided for them, those resources provide for me. And that connection to this place, I hope, is something that other tribal members will take with them, no matter where they go. If a young tribal member decides to go to Washington, D.C. to work on any number of issues, whether that's for Indian country or in education, I hope there is a sense of place that will always be home, that will always be a landscape that they can return to, that they can feel connected to, and feel that sense of belonging.
So I would say all of the issues that you discussed are so urgent, right, in our communities. And so even just thinking, okay, which do I feel is most important? I just feel like Native people have been assaulted in so many ways, our languages, our lands, our families, our educational systems. And so I can't kind of choose among them. Language revitalization, you know, I can introduce myself in Aleutic, and so I did, because I was taught by the person that taught me that it's important to reclaim even the smallest domain. I tell my kids Knukumkin at night. I know so few Aleutic words, but I can tell them I love you. So that's what I do. I'm slowly reclaiming little domains. So language revitalization work is I think, some of the most pressing work right now. And I'm not one of those people right now to carry that out. And so my role in that, I think, is education also is such a pressing issue. And so we work with Native youth who will say things like, well, I'm not Native, but my grandma is, right? Alienated from their sense of selves. And so part of our work is to say, you are Native, and what your grandma teaches you is important, you know? And to get kids wanting to learn languages, to get kids asking their grandparents to tell stories. And so part of that work in my role at the university is to help nurture the next generation of Indigenous educators. So it's taken for granted that kids will have a Native teacher sometime in their life. I never had, not until college, you know? And so having someone who can affirm you in the classroom, who can affirm that your language is important, that your culture is important, that your history is important, right? That the world around you, the natural world, the lands are important. And someone who can also educate you about your rights. I think rights are really important, especially when we're in this era of where termination almost feels like it's looming large again, right? Getting kids to understand if they're Native that they might have treaty rights, right? That sovereignty is just as important as kind of democratic ideals and pursuits of social justice. So, yeah.
And I'm going to kind of take it from there because you said how so many issues are urgent and may seem fraught with problems. So one of our questions is, one recurring concern for many Indian communities is that media focuses on negative issues, which have included poverty, racism, alcoholism, and unemployment. What are some of the more positive issues that need to be highlighted?
I think I'll take the, I'll start off this conversation. I think the successes need to be celebrated. I was, just after I started my new position, I was approached by someone that wanted to tell the story about one of the tribes. And they wanted photos, but they only wanted photos in, I think, what they called garb. And my response to them was, we have tribal members that are lawyers. We have tribal members that are doctors. We have tribal members that work in every aspect of society. Let us celebrate that, as well as the traditional dancers, as well as those that have turned their life around. So I think the successes are really something that we as a society need to work on recognizing and appreciating. But I also always tell my leadership that the responsibility to tell the Grand Ron story falls on Grand Ron. That is a story that no one else can tell. We can work with great media like Brian and Karen to tell different aspects of that story. But when it comes to telling the Grand Ron story, the only entity that can tell that story in its entirety is that of the tribe.
There have been lots of successes in the Indian country in our individual tribes. just the continued existence through all of that federal policy that was really designed to wipe us out in spite of treaties saying this was your permanent reservation, and then very quickly whittling it away from 1.1 million acres down to nothing by 1950s. And then actually surviving that, coming back to be restored in 1977. For a small community like ours that at that time was very scattered as well, a lot of our community members, they had lost their family lands and moved to Portland, Salem, Eugene. Some had been in the relocation program, moved to Oakland, California, Denver, Colorado, and other urban centers, Seattle. So survival is, I think, one of our greatest accomplishments and successes over the decades. And, you know, in the modern era, we have economic development. Gaming, of course, is the most prominent of those and the most lucrative. And I think gaming in itself has faced lots of challenges too, and that's ongoing. So facing those realities and finding ways to partner with our surrounding community to gain support for the protection of that resource and those communities around us, recognizing that we are a benefit when basically all of those communities, when they heard of a casino plan near them, they you know, predicted the end of the world and there was going to be prostitution and organized crime and all this stuff going on associated with this gaming center. And that has definitely not happened in any of the Oregon tribal casinos that I know of. So navigating the political world in a very contemporary sense, too, is, I think, one of our major successes that we all have to celebrate and acknowledge.
This is a little bit complicated for me. I hope I'm able to articulate what I'm thinking. And in so many ways, I agree with what Robert said, you know, being somewhat contemporary and living through some of those termination things. So let's see if I can share this with you. Native American data is horrific. I think it's often easy for media to pick up those ever-present horrific information about, you know, suicide rates and alcoholism rates and lack of graduation and dropout rates and all of the things that point to Native people as being somehow lacking or somehow not successful people. But in some ways, just the act of perseverance is a success. I think that we have to be very careful to make sure that we don't overlook the historical items that caused us to be who we are and what we are today. Some of the baggage that we carry, we simply cannot unpack in one or two generations. I think it's important that all stories are balanced. If you do not provide tribal people with the opportunity to actually explain to you their trauma, my grandfather was a boarding school child, my mother-in-law was a boarding school child, I was a terminated Indian, irrespective of my color in my hometown, I was regularly spit on for being tribal. You can't disavow that when speaking with Native people and try to gloss over it. Native people want you to know their history and their story. But as with what has already been said, that has to be balanced with the fact that Native people have survived. We're a bunch of persevering little cusses. I mean, we were here when people got here, and we'll be here when they're all gone. And that is a motto that my family always lived by. And those very successes, albeit small, Lalani bringing back her language, Robert and I basket weaving, those are small successes in terms of views by the dominant society. But in our world, those are phenomenal successes. And so in addition to bringing out successes, it's important to be able to show, to articulate, to teach why those successes are so important, why it's important to grab one word that I don't drive a car, the car takes me there. That very knowledge or that very seeing is a huge success when our children get it. And it's hard sometimes in today's media, you know, we all love drama and we all love trauma, but in today's media to get people to see that a minuscule thing is a phenomenal success. To say two or three kids from your tribe graduated from college sounds pitiful to the Western world, but it's something we all dance and celebrate and cry and are happy for. And so there has to be a balance, but in that balance of survival, we can't let the words of our elders and our old people who told us what happened be forgotten too. So it doesn't have to be just bad data. It has to be true history moving to contemporary success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really appreciate what you said about, you know, I think there really needs to be an emphasis on change makers in Indian country. I mean, there are so many, but that can't be outside of the context in which they're engaging in acts of hope and resistance, right? Like, we don't want to just paint a rosy history, because what happens is when you focus only on people's successes, then those people get held up as, oh, why couldn't you just be like them? But I think, you know, I'm always thinking about kids and what Native kids need. And so having media representations and curriculum that reflects Native change makers, right, that reflects, we had two Native women elected to Congress, right? We have Shoni Schimmel. She was Confederated Tribes of Umatilla, and she made the WNBA, her sister too, right? We have Native youth all over the state engaging in incredible acts of resistance and creating space for Native issues and aspirations. We have the Klamath youth. We have Tsleil-Waututh's Tribal Youth Council transforming Indigenous Peoples Day, right? Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. Like, I think kids need to know about that. And we were just talking before about Senate Bill 13, and teachers often want the curriculum. Oh, I can't wait till the curriculum is going to be written and I can use it in my classroom. And that's great and that's wonderful. But I would love teachers to tell the story of Senate Bill 13, tribal history, shared history, and how it passed. That was a profound act of civic empowerment on the part of Indigenous educators and leaders and allies in the state. And so stories like that deserve to be told, not just the content of the curriculum, you know, which... But the act of transforming the curriculum statewide, right? Because that gives people hope for the types of change that they could make in their own lives.
Essentially one of the big successes.
Yeah. That and
Rachel, how are we doing on time?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was just thinking that this would be a good time to open it up to audience questions.
Hey there. Appreciate you all being here today. I know, like you're saying, for Indigenous people, that just being here today is a success. So my question is to do with leadership. I was, like a lot of people, called to go to Standing Rock, and during that time there were diverse leaders, is one way we could say it. But, you know, there were different camps, and at the different camps they sort of looked at the resistance in a different way. And depending on what sort of leadership you're into, you found the person who you could feel good about following. And so I was just curious, do you guys see in your tribes different forms of leadership, be it traditional versus political, and, you know, what value do you see in the different aspects of leadership?
So one of the most pitiful and unfortunate things about tribal political systems nowadays was, of course, the Indian Reorganization Act, in which tribes were gifted a constitution based on what the benevolent paternal order of the Elks' constitution, a social and fraternal organization that discriminated against Natives and women. And as a result of being gifted that constitution, many tribes became, those constitutions and those political systems became substituted for traditional ways of learning and doing and knowing and being leaders and making decisions. My tribe personally works within the system of our constitution. It's the only legal way in which we are able to work. But the ways of leaders, doesn't have to be limited to your political system. Those are the voters and the decision makers. But there's leaders all over in different areas of our tribe. In the healing, the Canoe Healing family has its own set of leaders, and they have a different skill set than the political leaders who are making decisions. The Basket Weavers have their own group of leaders who have a different knowledge and skill set. I love the Cherokee leadership. They had a war leader and a peace leader, because the same person can't be both. You can't be both peaceful and warlike at the same time. So you have to rely on all of those different knowledges and skill sets. It's unfortunate, I think, in a lot of our contemporary societies where people are self-proclaimed leaders. My chief, Ed Bowen, my uncle, always said, I better turn around every now and then and see if people are following me. That's how I will know if I am a leader. And I always believe that you can't get too far out in front of the folks that you are herding, H-E-R-D-I-N-G, or you are an ineffective leader. So the whole concept of leadership is defined by our political constitution systems, whether we change them, But we also have subsystems of youth groups, of healing families, of the canoe journey, of our basket weavers. So there's a whole bunch of groups that have their own sets that bring the skills in that they need and that they want and that they'll choose.
That's pretty well put. We had our, for each of our tribes and bands, really, each village was a politically autonomous unit in the old days. When treaties were signed, there was, to some extent, folks selected to sign treaties. Some of that was by the U.S. officials wanting to conduct the treaty, so they sort of handpicked, in some cases, the folks who they thought they wanted to negotiate with. Largely, though, that was our community-recognized leadership. When we got to the reservation for the first decade or two, there was that continuing, although a very disrupted community. Each of those groups kind of had their own identified leadership, and once in a while a special agent would show up touring around the reservations and calling together all the chiefs and headmen on that reservation and getting their statements. And of course there were bitter complaints about all the promises that had been made that hadn't been carried out, that people were dying rapidly, the strong, the old, the young, all together were suffering the same way and being forced to labor in fields to grow crops that they weren't familiar with when they could have been putting up their traditional foods and getting ready for the winter. And when those crops failed, then they had to scramble like mad at the end of the year to try to survive that winter, and some of them weren't able to. So eventually there was a, when Joel Palmer, who during treaty making time had been the superintendent of Indian Affairs for Oregon, initially the territory, he came back to Siletz right about 1870, 71, and organized the first election of tribal leadership on the reservation. And so that was kind of a change of government for us. We had Chief George Harney, a Rogue River son of a, or nephew of one of our Rogue River War leaders, who was Tyee George. He was named after his uncle. So Chief George Harney was the first elected chief of all the Confederated tribes at Siletz. And right at the end of the Modoc War, he participated in a tour back east of Oregon tribal leaders. Alfred B. Meacham was the superintendent of Indian Affairs when that trip got organized, and then he lost his position and control of any funds around that time. So all of our leadership were back east, and we have a series of letters where Chief George Harney, his wife, baby, and his sister traveled with them too. Chief George Harney was writing from cities, sending messages, telegrams to the Siletz agent, which stage stop to send the, or train stop to send the next kind of Western Union forwarding of funds so that they could make their way home. And that's just, you know, kind of an example of the changes in how leadership was selected, how it was acknowledged in the community. When the Indian Reorganization Act was passed, there was a lot of negotiations that and different drafts of the bill that happened prior to its passage, and one of the early ones threatened to confiscate any remaining individual trust lands, allotment lands that had been assigned and were still held by families. That would be confiscated and redistributed so that families who had lost their allotments would have a land base on the reservation. So for families that still controlled some allotment lands, that was a very serious threat to their family. So the Indian Reorganization Act went down in flames at Siletz. We did said, we already have our own constitution. We drafted it years ago. We've had amendments to it. We have our own government. We don't need to be adopting this rubber-stamped Secretary of Interior-approved constitution. And so we were terminated under that original tribal constitution, but when we reorganized and went for restoration, we had to accept the Indian Reorganization Act. It was one of the requirements to being restored. So, and I totally agree with Brenda about there's all forms of leadership and for different areas of tribal culture, history, and politics. The kind of the sad thing is how tribes are pitted against each other, and how there's really no form of redress of a lot of those historical wrongs. There's either no avenue to get into court, or they have latches and other mechanisms of law to throw your case out very quickly.
I suppose I could just add that Indigenous people have been raised in the same racist, sexist, homophobic society that most people are raised in, and so sometimes Native leaders can reproduce some of the systems of oppression that harm tribal members. And so it's been often the burden of tribal members, you know, Native women, for example, holding their leadership accountable for making sure that policies and laws and practices didn't harm Native women and children, you know. So just as there are kind of Indigenous forms of leadership and government and traditional forms of leadership and governance, there's also ways that as tribal members we have to hold our own nations and communities accountable sometimes.
Yeah, connected to that is in 1870, President Grant instituted the peace policy, it was called, and it assigned official denominations to each of the reservations. And I thoroughly believe that it was to keep peace among the churches that were fighting for access to new convert
right.
populations on the reservations rather than anything to do with the people themselves.
Yep.
So, the separation of church and state was not questioned in that instance, and it did institute a lot of the teachings that then led to a lot of community problems, our social problems, and of course it the churches all were trying to stop liquor trade on the reservations and things like that were good efforts, but some of the more biased attitudes that got instilled in our people at that time are still challenges.
Yeah.
Another question in the back.
Hi, I'm Rachel. I'm a Chinook tribal member, and I am a second-year student in the Chinook Wawa language class here at LCC. And one of the things I've been hearing a lot in the news lately is the phrase Indian country, and I think still that most of the people who hear that phrase really think that Indian country is like a place, like a real place. And they don't understand that it's being used as a community, like in a community sense. And I grew up in Oregon schools and never heard anything about tribes at all, much less Oregon tribes, much less my tribe. And I'm really appreciating the history that the gentleman from Siletz is giving, and I know we have somebody with similar knowledge from Grand Ronde here. And I wonder, just for the listening audience especially, if you could just quickly explain to us how far-flung the various tribes and bands were that came onto Grand Ronde and onto Siletz. And I know something sort of similar happened at Warm Springs, but I think most people anywhere in the world, when they think about tribal reservations, I think they have this, still this maybe romantic idea that people were able to stay in their ancestral place. And that's certainly not the case in Oregon for the most part.
So before Siletz and Grand Ronde starts with where they came from, I want people here to start first with word usage. The word reservation has a root word of reserve. I find it absolutely cross-sticking when people say we gave them a reservation. I find that that is one of my biggest educational opportunities to say that the dominant government gave us nothing like that. And so the root word of reservation is reserve. Indian people gave or was taken under force with a reserved area of their indigenous lands. The term Indian country did not come into existence until 1872 in the Major Crimes Act for Native American people. When the, you know, we weren't even able to vote on all of the laws that impacted us. We were not citizens of this country until 1924. My grandparents remembered to me the first time they got to vote because they were not citizens of this country, even though they were born here. In 1872, when the Major Crimes Act was passed by Congress to define a punishment opportunity for Native American people, the word Indian country was first defined as any lands within the exterior boundaries of an existing reservation or any allotments that Native American people still had held in trust for them, or any lands that were their former reservations of which they still exercised jurisdictional control. So that term Indian country is an inaccurate misnomer for Indian land. The whole United States was Indian country. It is now has reservations. It now has allotments. The whole entire state of Oklahoma, by their very constitution, is defined as Indian country. They have an Oklahoma Indian Welfare Act that defines the entire state as Indian country. Oklahoma was established only for Native American residency. So my educational, I really appreciate the question, but my educational opportunity around that is to be knowledgeable of the words that you use and how they're used. That my tribe had a reservation that was taken back by executive order. We too were a removed tribe. And so there are so many ways that tribes get and lose lands and reservations and allotments that I really appreciate the opportunity for people to speak about what happened to them. But in the instance of Indian country, there is no such thing as Indian laws. There are laws about Indians that are around Indian country. So I just want to say that before she asks you two to answer those questions.
It's true that Indian country has a strict legal definition for purposes used and misused.
Yes.
And then there's the more colloquial representation by Indian people that all of the United States is Indian country, maybe except Hawaii. That's Kanaka country.
Indigenous country.
So, the use of those terms, it's like N-word and some of those hurtful, really ugly usages and reclaiming some of those things. I've never liked the term Native American. I thought it was clinical and sterile, didn't apply to me. It was so it didn't really refer to any specific group of people. And I love the term indigenous. In Mexico, I was in Mexico City in the 80s, and there was an indigenous man from Oaxaca that was there studying at a university, one of the first from his community to get to that level of education. And he was talking about the adoption of the term indígena and the promotion by Native people of that term, which is, of course, indigenous. And there was so much public backlash because they love the term Indio, Mestizo, and things that had been really derogatory terms in a lot of people's minds, and they didn't want to give up the usage of those terms. So this man stood up, young, tall, nice-looking Native man, and was talking about that. And we were in a restaurant. We were kind of the center of the room, and all these tables around us got quiet, and all those faces turned towards him, and were basically staring at. And you could just see him feel their eyes on his back, and trying to avoid eye contact with them from the front. So, the adoption of terms like that for reversing the meaning of them, I think, is important in a lot of ways. Sorry.
So just a quick history about the Grand Ronde tribe. So the Grand Ronde tribe has over 30 tribes and bands associated as the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde of Oregon. And our ancestral homelands include Western Oregon, they include Southern Washington, and went into Northern California. The tribes were removed to the reservation. We have both ratified and unratified treaties that called for the removal, and marches like the Rogue River Trail of Tears were not isolated incidences. And I think that is a part of history that often gets ignored mm-hmm. or forgotten. And we have a responsibility to tell. The tribes were removed at the reservation, and we faced many of the same challenges that the other tribes faced. Changes in diets, loss of language, boarding schools, loss of cultural practices, loss of religion. And like the Siletz and like other tribes in Western Oregon, the federal government in its wisdom passed the Western Oregon Termination Act and terminated our federal status. What I always find interesting, and this comes in, I see this play out in Blood Quantum. I am, part of my lineage is Chinook. And at the end of the Clinton administration, the Chinook Nation had federal recognition for a very brief amount of time. I actually received a letter from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I still have it, saying that my blood quantum had changed. And then when that recognition was then taken away, I got another letter from the Bureau of Indian Affairs saying, never mind. And what that does to me is demonstrate mm-hmm. that the tribes of this place have not changed. Whether or not the federal government chooses to recognize them is what changes. Mm-hmm. You know, we are people of this landscape. This landscape provides for us. It has historically, it has traditionally, and it always will. Whether or not the federal government chooses to recognize that is a different story. And I commend the Chinook for continuing their effort for recognition.
Yeah, I forgot that part of the question. And basically, our claimed ancestral territory, which of course has overlaps with a lot of other recognized and unrecognized groups or tribes. So, everything west of the summit of the Cascades in Oregon, extending into the upper Klamath River, Shasta River, Scott River areas of Northern California, and down along the coast, basically Crescent City to the Oregon border, Smith River, Lake Earl country. And then along the lower Columbia River, we have a lot of Chinook and Clatsop ancestry at Siletz. When the reservation was established, the executive order that established our reservation, November 9th of 1855, signed by President Franklin Pierce, said for the Coast, Willamette, and Umpqua tribes. And at that time, they were still intending to maintain a, what had, in the Treaty of 1853 in the Rogue Valley, been described as a temporary reservation at Table Rocks until the president selected a permanent reservation. So Rogue River tribes weren't named in that original executive order, but 3 days later, Joel Palmer wrote the letter because the last stage of the Rogue River Wars had broken out, and he said the miners and settlers are never going to leave these people at peace on their reservation in the Rogue Valley, that they also need, there needs to be approved federal policy to designate their permanent reservation at Sillette's, and they made plans to remove them to the what was called Upper Farm, upriver from the agency at Sillette's. And so there was an encampment that was established on the South Fork of the Amhill as a staging area for a removal to Sillette's agency. And because they bought out some early donation land claim interests of the early white settlers there, they said, well, we bought those lands for Indian purposes, and it should be added to the reservation already established. That was the plan going forward. That's the recommendation that went to Washington. And in June of 1857, right after the majority of the Rogue River Shasta and Cow Creek people had been removed to Upper Farm at Sillette's agency. So about a month later, President Buchanan signs the order creating the Grand Round Reservation. And that's part of this federal policy that starts pitting people against each other. So instead of having one large reservation, there's two reservations sharing a border. And then they start trying to figure out how to reduce that land mass and only have to have one agency to manage. And the rest is history. They took most of the land, eventually took all of it, set us adrift under federal policy, no longer recognized us as tribal governments. Individually, if you look at the Western Oregon Termination Act, it does not erase us as Indians. It took away the federal recognition of us as a tribal government.
And just in addition, if I may, the federal recognition that Grand Ronde received in 1983 and 77
for
Sillette's 84. That is not something that came easily. It was something that tribal leaders had to fight for. The federal government just didn't say, oh, sorry, made a mistake, here you go. Our tribal leaders had to walk the halls of Congress. They had to lobby. They had to raise funds in order to work for years, in order to fight for recognition. Mm-hmm. And so it was just not something that was easily granted. And we see that with the Chinook, who are still fighting that fight today.
Yeah. So my tribe, the Kuslumpquansayuslar, our Aboriginal homeland, was the mouth of the Coos River, east up the river to the base of the Coast Range, straight up the Coast Range till 26 miles south of Cottage Grove, and it cut back out on a kitty corner back to just north of Florence. And that housed the Umpquas, some of the Umpquas, the Kuich, my tribes, the Hannes and Millitkus, making people of the mouth of the river, and the Shushla, who were people of the bend of the river. And so when removal happened, my tribe was also removed. The ultimate goal was to remove them to the Sillette's Reserve, but because of complications and delays, they ended up being put in a presidential executive order reserve at Yahats. Being at Yahats from 1859 to 1864, they were kept in a military stockade. They cleared all the land, and at the end of 10 years, the land was absolutely beautiful. And the president, what the president gives, the president can take. And by a comparable executive order, the Yahats Reserve was closed. The doors of the military stockade were opened, and my family was told, my people were told to go away. We weren't given the opportunity to then go on and join with the Salettes or be removed on. It was a simple go away. Some of my family returned to the Coos Bay area. I am very, very fortunate in that my fifth great-grandmother gave her daughter to a white family. She was hidden in a stump at about the age of 1.5 or 2. She possibly would have died on the trip. Her mother did die somewhere on the trip. My tribal name is Sa'avista. I am named after that woman who walked. When my fifth great-grandmother's brother came back home without his mother, he went to the white family and got my grandmother back. She did not know how to speak Indian. She had slept in beds, wore shoes, ate with silverware. It was a real culture shock for her to be returned to her people. But because of my fifth great-grandmother's mother giving her away, I'm here today. It was a horrific move that we don't teach in Oregon history because it's so sad. History isn't to make anyone feel guilty. History is what happened, and we want to learn it so we don't ring that same bell again. If you look on this wonderful picture that has been provided, this is Amanda. There's a place at Yahats for Amanda. It's now embraced. She is now embraced by Yahats. She was attempted to be murdered on the removal. She was blind. They said you could see where she walked by the blood from her feet. She was thrown into the ocean and survived, that perseverance that we're still here, that Robert also spoke of. Yahats now embraces this woman. It is difficult for me to drive through Yahats because of what happened to my people there. Those stories don't ever die. They're just told over and over again. And so the goal of getting us all to Salettes didn't happen, and thus divided where everyone goes nowadays because our lands do overlap. Our service areas overlap. We overlap each other. And unfortunately, when that happens and people, tribes object, local communities see it as we're taking something from the local community as opposed to protecting something for ourselves. It's, as Robert said, about the gaming and things like that. So when you stop and think about these kinds of pictures, and especially here in Western Oregon, every little parcel, every postage stamp size piece of land was utilized by tribal people, and many of us have intermarried, many of us have become related by blood and by marriage, and so our lands are a little bit fluid. Politically, they don't allow us to be that fluid.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. We've actually gone over time, so I really want to thank all of you wonderful folks for joining us and sharing your wisdom. This has been really extraordinary.
Thank you.